The following program is pre-recorded. Hello, everyone. This is Jerry Pippin, and welcome to our UFO show. Well, over the weekend in Aztec, New Mexico, up in the Four Corners area, they had their 14th annual Aztec Conference. And by all reports, it was very, very successful. Had 225 people for Saturday, 150 people for the dinner, meet and greet on Friday night. And I've known some major UFO conferences that did not have many more than that in easy to reach metropolitan areas. So Katie McClure, you did a great job. And Katie had some comments to make, and she did this right outside the high school where they had the conference, and she told Janet Saylor a little bit about this year's conference. Janet Saylor covered the conference for us as our special correspondent, and we appreciate those efforts. And Katie McClure, of course, is the director of the Aztec Conference, the symposium, and, you know, she's connected with the Friends of the Library.
And I think what's really different this year is we have room. We're not feeling claustrophobic. This Aztec High School multi-purpose room is beautiful. The sound is great. The screen in the back is great. Everybody can hear. I haven't gotten one complaint this year that someone can't hear. So we have this great sound guy. And a lot of people. We had a lot of new people. I took a poll with people raising their hands. And last night, 50% of the people or more in the audience had never been to our symposium before. So I think the word is getting out there, you know, around the Four Corners and beyond, obviously.
You know, Janet has her own symposium coming up last week of October, 25 through 30, and that'll be in New Mexico as well, up in Taos at the Calchina Lodge. And we'll be talking to Janet about that in detail somewhat later. But we do have a link to her website. In fact, she has two websites about it. And you can just go over to aspiefiles.org, probably the easiest way to get there. And there's a link also to the conference page. And the conference page has a separate website, too, as a matter of fact, and to find out what she has in store. But right now, she has something in store for us, and that's a report on Aztec.
You know what? This is a compelling man. I mean, very compelling man.
Unfortunately, she's not talking about me. She's talking about Stephen Jones, one of the speakers at Aztec, and he has a new book out. He's from the UK, and Stephen will be at Janet's conference in October, up in Taos, by the way. He was an abductee for 50 years.
50 years, that's right. He's 55 now, and so for 50 years of his life, this is what he's been doing. But he says he was like he was turned on or reawakened or something about 10 years ago in 2000, 2001, that suddenly the information, you know, it wasn't just being abducted and being talked to and everything. He was getting information about how this was going to affect him personally, and how the whole movement, I guess you might want to call it, is going to be affecting all the people on Earth.
Stephen Jones's book is The Invitation to the Dance, The Awakening of the Extended Human Family. I take your word for it. He's an interesting man. We'll be doing a show about him with you and maybe him a little later on. And definitely we'll see him in Taos. Now, there were a lot of other things happened at Aztec, Janet. And one of the things was Chuck Wade's presentation, in which he really laid out some pretty interesting things about this piece of a UFO that he found on the St. Augustine Plains there in New Mexico.
I think I emailed you this last night. He may end up being the guy, as far as, in my opinion, he may actually end up being the guy with the smoking gun. They've been looking for pieces of this and pieces of that, and people want to see, you know, they want to see a piece of the ship. They want hard evidence. I think he's got it. And he's like a dog with a bone. He just will not let it go, and he keeps getting more and more definitive information about these pieces of metal and foil that he has. And, you know, as our technology gets better, the tests that he's able to get done, and they're expensive, you know, so it's taking a while to get all these things done. But the tests that he's been able to get completed reveal more and more information, which, you know, point directly to an extraterrestrial source. So he showed some pictures of a cross-section, and from his description of it and an explanation of the little pieces of iron and silicon and stuff that were within the cross-section, it's not something that can be either naturally occurs on Earth, nor can it be made. And he's checked with the big people, the Alcoa people, you know, and they're all saying, no, you can't make this. It doesn't occur naturally on Earth. This is not from this planet. And yet it was obviously it's a machined piece. Like I said, he may have the smoking gun.
Sorry about the terrain noise. I left the patio door open here in the studio. That's not an Aztec. That's here in Oklahoma, in Muskogee, where we have a train running every 10 minutes. Janet, good luck on the 2011 symposium, the Paranormal Symposium Film Festival, and all kinds of interesting things you're having this year in Taos, New Mexico, at the Calchina Lodge. Early bird discount, I think, is in effect now.
Yes, we've got, I've forgotten what the date is now. I think it's June. The early bird discount is in effect right now, Spirit. And this is the time to get the best bargain. And there are also additional discounts for, like, seniors and first responders, EMTs, police people, that kind of thing. You can become a member and get another discount. I mean, there's just all kinds of ways to come to this event.
Okay, that's October 25th through 30th in Taos, New Mexico. Janet, thanks for reporting in.
Okay.
We'll be back in a moment with some comments about the remote viewing aspect of the Aztec conference and symposium. And in addition to that, we have some very interesting interviews. So don't go away. I'm Jerry Pippin. Investigator and author Anthony Sanchez.
The name of the book is UFO Highway. I found that although I was diverging into multiple areas of UFO research, I kept finding myself back on the same road. And I found that all these different aspects of ufology were interconnected. So I decided to call the book UFO Highway.
This is the book that could not wait for a regular publisher. It had to be released now. The information is so sensitive, so shocking, so well researched. Colonel X comes from the dark shadows for the light of truth. The inside story of Area 51 and the challenging truth about extraterrestrials. The e-book of the century, now on sale. For information and to order, go to UFOHighway.com. This is Jerry Pippin again, and by the way, interestingly enough, the Highway 101 guy will be at Janet Saylor's Taos Symposium, the 2011 symposium this year. So you might want to get by and, you know, go over to her website and make that early bird registration. That's aspiefiles.org. And I think you'll find it a very interesting situation this year, as it's up in Taos, New Mexico, which is one of the oldest, if not the oldest, community in the United States. Well, we always think about people in Massachusetts, but Native Americans had something going on in Taos for a long, long time. Let's do one more thing about Aztec, and that's concerning remote viewing. If you listened last week, you know we featured a remote viewing interview not only Whip Lynn Buchanan, who did the remote viewing in Aztec, but also with Russell Targ, one of the pioneers of remote viewing for the CIA and other people. And we had a very interesting show. I thought about that. Now, we're going to do another remote viewing show very shortly. If you'd like to follow up on some of the things that you heard in the first part of the show, they'll be being added to our website this week with a couple of programs of interest. And you might go over and check it regularly, jerrypippin.com. That's J-E-R-R-Y-P-I-P-P-I-M-P as in Paul, all one word, jerrypippin.com. Interesting thing happened. Lynn Buchanan did a show with us last year in which he had these remote viewers from around the world slated to do a blind study, but they all tuned into the show. So he had to go find seven additional remote viewers and task them on a little bit more about the craft itself, the crash, how it happened. And as Lynn Buchanan told the audience there in Aztec on Saturday, he'd like to find out how it works. Evidently, it's a little pocket-sized thing, almost like out of Star Trek, that they disconnect from the craft when they leave. And it has all the power for the extraterrestrial vehicle or RV or whatever you want to call it. It's an alternative energy device for sure. One of the very shocking and disturbing things that came out of this new set of remote viewers was the fact that they executed not one, but several ETs from this crash. I guess there were 16 altogether. And their excuse, the Army, if that's who it was, and Lynn and his remote viewers couldn't tell for sure, they knew they were officials, official capacity of some sort. And basically, they executed them because, are you ready for this? A sickening excuse. And that is that it was a Cold War, and we didn't know what to do with them. Come on. Give me a break, guys. We have shown not a very civilized manner toward extraterrestrials. And so there's no wonder, if you stop and think about it, that they've never really gone public. It'd be somewhat like a landing in an island in the Pacific or someplace that's full of cannibals, and you walk up and you say peace, and they grab you, and the next thing you know, you're in the soup pan. So, you know, they got you in the pot of soup. So we've not shown a very civilized manner toward extraterrestrials. Anthony Sanchez, who has that interesting story about Dulce and his Colonel X, I mean, he has his book, UFO Highway 101, is rampant with indications of us just not being very civilized. We've been, the military handled it, and it appeared the military was doing what they do best, and that's kill people or kill ETs. So I don't know what's progressed since then. But at least back there in the 40s, from 1945 with that first crash, which happened right outside the White Sands Missile Test Range, and obviously the ETs were checking our nuclear activities at the time, right up on through 1948 at Aztec, it's not that far from Los Alamos, where we developed all of this. We probably were being investigated, and as Chuck Wade revealed on Saturday, and he's done that on our show before, we were probably using that high-powered radar back in those days that screwed up avionics. We're probably using it as a weapon to down as many UFOs as we could. Stanton Friedman and others have indicated that they have evidence that we had an undeclared war against extraterrestrials, at least up through 1952-53 frame. And I guess we finally backed off when they figured out we couldn't win. And maybe we haven't backed off at all. Now, let's get to something else that's happening, and that's the Ozark UFO Conference coming up in April. And I was thinking about what I'd like to do on the show tonight, and I think what I want to do, since I just had the UFO Congress at its new location in Phoenix with the Open Minds people, and they made a deal to get a lot of Wendell Stevens information and books and research, I thought it'd be interesting to play another Wendell Stevens interview. And we have one here that we're going to play that we did actually at Eureka Springs, and it featured Wendell Stevens when he was alive, and God rest his soul. Very, very interesting man, and he was actually instrumental in me becoming interested in UFOs at all. I heard him on the radio one time. I said, well, I probably better do some shows like that. In this interview, Wendell Stevens talks about an encounter with a top-secret operative of the U.S. government who worked at a place called S2, which I think you'll find very interesting when we play this interview. And, you know, it's interesting. I can see Wendell and his bright blue eyes sitting there in the lobby of the hotel in Eureka Springs, telling me about this, and they just gleamed or sparkled. S2 is located in Nevada, and evidently the man that Wendell is going to be talking about was exposed to a strange ailment that killed him within months of meeting Wendell Stevens. Now, was this on purpose? Or was it an accident or a byproduct of biological experiments? The man believed they were killing him on purpose because he had knowledge of special projects, which included a space base on another planet. And 18 assassinations were carried out by this man, and was ordered by a Secret Service agency of the U.S. government. And then later on in this interview, we're going to play a sidekick to Ted Phillips. And this fellow is no longer working with Ted Phillips. And Ted Phillips has kind of gone underground a little bit. He's still alive and still doing well, contrary to a lot of rumors. But he's kind of taking a low profile for a little while on purpose, and I'm not exactly sure exactly why, because he's so low profile he won't talk to me either. Anyway, we're going to feature this interview with Adam Johnson. And it's a follow-up to a previous show in this series of programs we did with Ted Phillips in Eureka Springs, and they talk about the Marley Woods incidents in Missouri. I think you'll find that interesting, too. So let's go ahead and roll that show. Blast from the Past. This is Jerry Pippin, and here we are, of course, in Eureka Springs, Arkansas again. Wendell Stevens, always good to see you. We've done a lot of shows from Eureka Springs.
Yes, you sure have.
You didn't have any trouble getting here, huh?
No, I didn't have any trouble. I had a Continental Airlines ticket. American passengers did have trouble, though.
Well, you're an old pilot, and I mean that respectfully. I didn't quite understand that wire.
I couldn't see where there was a real safety hazard, because the problem was the spacing on the straps that hold the bundles of wire together should have been 4 inches apart, and it was 6 inches apart. So they clipped them all off and put 4-inch binds on, banding on all those bundles of wire. That was the safety problem.
So looks like somebody was exerting their power here. I guess we'll leave it at that. you talked about Billy Meyer again here.
Yes.
Anything new there? I know Mike Horn has a new DVD out about
it. Yes, he does. It's a nice DVD. It's well done. It's got a lot of images of Billy Meyer when he was a younger man that I never had before.
Now, you when you met him, how old was he?
Well, I think he looked like he was in his middle 30s when I first met him. Yes, and he's up in his middle 60s now.
And so, and how many times have you been over there?
I went over there 11 times, and I spent...
Yeah, I knew it was a lot.
Yeah. All at my expense, my own money, too. And I stayed anywhere from a week to 2 weeks each time in his household, living in a room upstairs, right with his family, watching everything going on. I worked with him, hauling manure for their gardens and picking rocks out of the gardens and helping them grade the road and things like that to be useful while I was there.
Well, you know, we have a couple of interviews with you on our website that people can find and listen to, in which you talked in great detail about some of your experiences with Billy Meyer.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought if it'd be okay with you, we might talk to you about a few of these other things happening. What else has piqued your interest these days?
Well,
you're always writing, and as you explained to me one time, it's not exactly like a book, but it is a book. It's more like an Air Force report.
It's a report. It's a report, like a journalistic report or like a military report. Uh-huh. I'm used to writing military reports, and I write like that, just like a journalistic report of events as they happen. I'm not a writer. I don't write with an introduction, a build-up, a climax, and a close. That's how books are written. I write the events as they happen, with all the data in the event. It's like a journalistic, like you read in a newspaper. The surprises come wherever they happen during the investigation.
What have you been investigating recently? Yeah, you've been doing a lot of traveling, making appearances at conferences. Maybe you haven't had time to investigate anything.
Well, I haven't had much time to do a lot of investigating. I went to Argentina at their invitation just a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, really?
And they had a conference scheduled at Rosario, which is about 80 kilometers mm-hmm. from Buenos Aires. When we got to Buenos Aires, though, we found that huge produce trucks, were blocking all the roads out of the city because the new woman president had increased the tariff, the tax, on produce 50%. And the truckers weren't going to accept it, and in protest, they used their big trucks and blocked all the roads so nobody could get in or out of Buenos Aires. Until she went on the radio and agreed to moderate it a bit, she cut the 50% down to 25%. They moved the trucks that night, but the next morning, they're back again. They had another meeting and decided that wasn't enough.
Well, we never
did get out of Buenos Aires.
So
what we did is went down to Pedro Romniak's house. Pedro Romniak is the Heineken of South America.
Uh-huh.
We went out to his little house on the outskirts of Buenos Aires, where we had a mini meeting of about 50 or 60 people that he got together on quick notice and did a presentation anyway. You know, I have been wanting to meet Pedro Romniak all my life. He was one of the prime contactees of the Umites. When they were coming into Spain, they would contact the Spanish scientists by letter, using a public stenographer to write their letters, and they put the seal on it, and the stenographer would mail it. So they wrote a letter to Pedro Romniak in Argentina, but in the letter to Pedro Romniak, they sent a photograph of their ship, an Umite photograph. The Umite pictures are different from our technology. Their flat two-dimensional picture is perfect three-dimensional. The emulsion is made up of little discs of reflective material that scattered all through the emulsion in such a way that when you look at the picture, you can move your head and look behind.
You hold a snapshot and you move it around.
Has depth, like looking in a box.
Wow.
And I wanted to see that, and his room is house is like mine. He's got stuff piled everywhere. We couldn't find it.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah. I'd love to have seen it.
But they literally wrote him a letter, huh?
They wrote him several letters. With the Umite seal on, he had the originals. He sent me a copy of one of the originals way back when he was having these contacts.
And where does that stand at this day?
The Umites are still in contact with Spanish scientists. They have not. They have 18 other missions around the world, and we don't hear anything of the other missions. They're in strange countries like Zimbabwe and Bolivia, Argentina, Australia, outback.
I wonder why they chose those third world countries for.
Well, they had a base in Germany and Denmark and Yugoslavia, England also, mm-hmm. and it was a two in the United States. So they are in first world countries. But they, when they discovered us way back in 1949, they became so interested in Earth phenomena because of the extreme variety we have in all species and types and classes of all living things. And they say that this peculiar variety comes from a particularly harsh sun and reduced attenuation. When the flood came down, it cleared the skies. We saw it for the first time. It also allowed sharper radiation to come through from the sun. And it caused all lifespans to be decreased to 10%. Remember, all Earth lifespans before Moses were 1,000 years.
So no, yeah, in the Bible.
And after the flood,
Methuselah.
He lived 1,009 years. Uh-huh. After the flood, all lifespans of all things on the planet were reduced to 10%. So we have short lifespans, a harsh sun causing rapid mutation, and we become the laboratory rats for all the other species. They come here to view mutation in progress.
Any chance that our lifespan is going to extend back to what it was, or is the sun just too powerful?
It's too powerful. If we could figure a way to do the shielding, like building domes over the whole cities, then we might be able to increase the lifespans of the people who live under the domes. But I don't see any progress in that direction.
When we talk about Brazil, I know you've been down there several times. Mm-hmm. You don't speak Portuguese, do you?
No, but I translate it.
Do you? How do you do that?
I can read it, but
okay,
I can't pronounce it.
Understand.
It's Spanish with a kind of a French accent on it that's hard for my tongue.
But you can read it?
I read it, yes.
Yeah. How many times have you been to Brazil? Five or six?
Maybe a dozen or more.
Oh, more than that, huh?
Mm-hmm.
I know we've talked about some pretty interesting things that have happened in Brazil over the years and our programs. Brazil seems to be an interesting place for UFO ET contact. Why?
Well, probably because of the size of it. Brazil is bigger than the whole United States, for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
It has the dense jungles that were very remote and difficult to get to. So there was a lot of Brazil that remained unexplored for a long time. And, are you familiar with the Adrien case in Miami, Florida?
No, tell me about that.
He was being contacted by what he said were Pleiadian humans that took him to an underground base in the southwest highlands of Brazil, where those alien extraterrestrials were working in harmony with two other different race types in their underground facility. And he was taking...
Yeah, race types from other...
From other worlds. Three different worlds working in harmony in an underground
base.
What
were the other
facility.
Two race types? Sure.
Well, one was a gray species, and the other one was another human species.
Okay.
And they were getting along very well, and they had ships from all three of the societies in the underground hangars there. And way back in the 30s, a German explorer by the name of Brugger discovered the aliens there. He was exploring in the region, studying the wild natives that lived there, and somebody mentioned that there was Americans upstream. They took him up to meet the Americans. They turned out to be the extraterrestrial humans. And at that time, they were worried about the destruction of the forests in Brazil and encroaching civilization on their society, and afraid they would be discovered and driven out. And they asked this German explorer if he could do anything for them. And when he got home after that to Germany, he told Germans he wrote a book about his trip in Brazil. And word got to Goering, and he had told the aliens in Brazil that he would see what he could do about getting them some help to stop the encroachment of civilization on their area. So he told Goering about it, and Goering sent 2,000 German soldiers up into that area of Brazil. He sent them to the east coast of Brazil in submarines, and they went by a submarine ashore on rubber dinghies and then hired taxis and things to get to a river port and bought steamer tickets up the river as far as they could go where the native tribes would take over and forward them right into where the aliens were. So the 2,000 German soldiers got to the alien facility where they set up a defense perimeter inside of the aboriginals. And they married Indian women. They were all single German soldiers. They married Indian women, raised families, and the offspring of those families grew up going to school, the local schools run by the alien visitors. So they grew up being educated in alien technology, and the young German pilots now in their low 20s, by the time Adrienne was taken down there, they were young pilots. German pilots from those families had been raised in their schools were working with those extraterrestrials and flying their vehicles. So, Adrian,
you're talking about flying the ET?
They were flying the ET, the discs, flying discs.
Uh-huh.
And the Germans had even built the versions of the flying discs themselves. So they had German versions that were being flown by German pilots, and German pilots flying some of the alien extraterrestrial vehicles. And when Adrian and his living girlfriend were taken down there, they're still using a little plastic Polaroid camera. She took pictures of Adrian with his back to the camera and one of the German pilots standing beside him watching three craft landing on little platforms, landing platforms down there in the jungle area. And I tried to get copies of those pictures. I was never allowed to possess it.
Was this after World War II or before?
It was after World War II.
After World War II. I know we talked about the Nazi influence in the ETs one time, you and I did. And
yeah.
You said you ran across some pretty interesting papers in Wright-Patterson. It was Patterson Field back then.
Had them shredded and burned because I didn't know what they were. And later I found out that one of them was a map of the 9 Kugelblitz bases in the greater Germany that was very important to UFO research, but I didn't know it at the time because it was not in the need-to-know loop. And I shredded them and burned them.
So you think the German government today officially knows a lot about ETs?
No. The German government...
did that happen? That they don't know now.
When the Germans were helped to build the flying discs way back during the war, the alien visitors that helped them had another motive. They thought that the reason humanity was so belligerent was because they weren't familiar enough with each other. Only the rich could travel by steamer or by airliner. And they thought if we could mix better, we could become more acquainted with each other, more familiar with each other, we would lose some of our belligerence. So seeing, they thought if they could give us an air transport that could be used very economically. It didn't require fuel, didn't require a big infrastructure out of town, and everything like that, everybody could travel freely because costing practically nothing to do so. So they began helping the German engineers. There was a surplus of German engineers after World War I when we bombed out and destroyed their factories. Then they went in and built new factories with aid programs and new material supply lines. So now we had new factories, new lines, new production facilities, and a lot of surplus German engineers. So the Aldebaran visitors concluded this would be the ideal place to build the airliners of the future. And they actually started and got operational discs. And when they saw the Germans invert a tank turret on the bottom of one and fire it, they realized that they may be giving us a bigger and better weapon. They sabotaged the whole program and left.
So in other words, it's not a new story. It's an old story through time. Somebody tries to help somebody else, and somebody figures out how to weaponize it.
Yeah. So the German engineers, in a couple of years, they were able to work around the sabotage efforts and get the program going again. They actually built flying discs before the war ended. They had the first ones under test by 1941. By 1940, I think it was 44 when we began our carpet bombing of the Schweinfurt bearing plant and the Plasti oil fields. And we had a 800 bomber mission on one night going into Germany. I think that was to the Plasti oil fields. 800 bombers. That's a lot of bombers.
Yes, it is.
And that night, the Germans had 9 Hanabus operational. They only used 6 of them. They launched them that night against the carpet bombing fleet. and they brought down one-fourth of the fleet, 200 bombers in one night, and over 3,000 crewmen.
And you're talking about four or six?
Only six Honoboos. Okay. And the Honoboos only had two weapons aboard. One of them
what
was,
kind of weapons were these?
One of them was called a Motorstoffel. It was nothing more than a beam, an electromagnetic beam that interrupted ignition circuits, caused engines to fail. That was one weapon. The other weapon was nothing but aerosol cans filled with benzene. It was dropped ahead of the bomber fleet with the spray valve open, creating a cloud of vapor. When the bomber fleet flew into the cloud of vapor, they'd get a big explosion, would take out a dozen bombers at a time. And when, on the other hand, when they caused the ignitions to fail, they were flying in such close formation to get gun coverage all around the fleet that if an engine began to misfire and fail, it would back into the one behind it. And that would cause him to back into another, if he turned away, he'd get the ones on the side.
As they flew in tight formation.
Yeah, so we lost 200 airplanes in one night. That's one-fourth of the fleet. We couldn't have continued the war at that rate. But
when you were in the Air Force, did you have an occasion to see any of those reports, what our version of that was? I wonder what we thought.
At that time, no. No, I was not. I was out in the Pacific. I was a fighter pilot in the Pacific.
I understand that. And you told me, I think, one time you really never really saw a UFO until you were flying in a private plane up towards Chicago someplace.
Yeah, right. I never saw a Foo Fighter or anything like that. I heard about them, but I never saw it.
Mm-hmm. So, but you have no doubt this probably happened with the Nazis.
I'm convinced that it happened, that it did happen, and they succeeded in getting operational. What baffles me is after that success, which was turning the tide of war, all of the Honoboos were ordered out of Germany. Within 10 days, they were gone and never returned, never came back. And then Germany collapsed, and the Germans had...
So Germany, at that point, lost their ET support.
Well, either that or somebody else ordered the Honoboos out and wouldn't let them. Somebody else is controlling the progress of wars, and the winner is already calculated. They know who the winner is going to be, and that was changing the course of war, and they weren't going to allow it, whoever that is.
So are we talking about somebody else, like a new world
order? Bigger than governments. Bigger than national governments that ordered the Honoboos out of Germany to stop the changing of the progress of the war.
Have you... done any, you've written, 80-some-odd books?
No, 31.
31?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you're 85, right?
Yeah.
Okay, I got that part right.
Yeah.
31, that's still a lot of books. I'm reading that at all. Have you ever done anything about the New World Order and maybe the ET influence?
No, I haven't.
What do you think of that?
Well, I mean,
we've never discussed this.
Yeah. I'm inclined to agree that we need a one-world government, that we're never going to enter the community of space travelers until we get a one-world government. Mm-hmm. Because as the situation stands now, if the aliens approach the American government, the Chinese and Russians wouldn't accept it. If they approach the Russians, the Chinese and Americans wouldn't. If it's approached the Chinese and Russians, the Americans would not accept it. So we're not going to let anybody become the dominant power and control the world at the present stage of events, of affairs. And we have to get to a point where we do have somebody speaking for this planet. And then we can begin interplanetary commerce, which has never begun for us.
But you think it's out there?
I think it's there, waiting. I think we have to get to a one-world government in order to join the community of planets that are waiting and available.
So instead of T-shirts from China, we might have them from Alpha Centauri?
Yeah.
Interesting thought. We're talking with Wendell Stevens. I'm Jerry Pippin. We'll be right back.
Why visit the Grand Canyon in Arizona? Marv Mason knows why.
Mainly because the Grand Canyon is known as one of the seven natural wonders of the world.
No one gives a more personalized tour or knows more about the Grand Canyon than Marvelous Marv.
My main thing is education on the geology, because the Grand Canyon is a life record. It shows us where we were at one time on the planet with the continental drift and all the layers that were laid down by sediments, and then how the canyon was carved. And, of course, the views, you know, picture doesn't do it justice. But it's nice to have somebody there tell you about it that's lived there.
It's the best way to tour the Grand Canyon. Mar picks you up in a modern van at your hotel in the Grand Canyon area and takes you on a day-long tour. Contact Marvelous Mar Vacation Tours. Call and talk to him personally. 928-707-0291. Or visit his website.
MarvelousMar.com. Real easy, real easy.
It's Jerry Pippin, and we are at the end of the Ozarks in Eureka Springs, of course, at the Ozark UFO Conference. Wendell Stevens. Really, Wendell, I think I'd call you the dean of UFO researchers. There's other people like Bob Dean, and other people have been around, but 31 books, and you've been doing this now, what, 40 years, 50 years?
Yeah. Since I was, since 1947.
Well, we can add that up real fast.
That's 60 years.
That's 61 years.
Yeah.
So anyway, who are you?
My name is John Smith.
And where are you from, John?
Timbuktu.
I don't know if he's really telling us the truth or not. Go ahead, John. You have a question for Wendell.
I came in a little late, so that you might have already covered this, but what were the name of the things that you said were withdrawn from Nazi Germany?
Hanabus. They called them Hanabutu.
Hanabus. What are those? Were those?
They're a flying disc about 100 feet in diameter.
Okay.
That worked under free energy. They didn't require any fuel to fly. They had gravity control and could rise and descend vertically. They could hover in the air. They had a degree of invisibility when they were under power and the force field was produced around them.
Okay, this sounds similar to the fellow who was on Coast the other night. I think his book is The Brotherhood of the Bell. Are you familiar with it?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
What is his name? Do you remember?
I don't remember.
He's
going
to start working with Richard Hoagland. Their work has dovetailed, and they're going to start working together. But he's done research along these lines also.
So in other words, they had flying discs, the Nazis did.
Yes.
But these are different than that.
We may be talking about the same thing. The Nazi flying discs were bell-shaped. They were almost identical to the Adamski-type spacecraft.
Well, the ones from the 50s, right.
Yeah.
And anyway, John, you got anything else?
I believe that'll do for now.
Okay. Thanks a lot for coming by. Wendell, when we talk about the Nazis and the New World Order, and then you're talking about really there's nobody on this planet that can speak for the planet, how do you envision this ever changing? We're pretty tribal, I guess.
I think it's very grim the way the situation lays right now. We're in a conflict we can't seem to get out of. I see our political situation deteriorating, personally. I am afraid that it may deteriorate to something that's even worse that we can't get out of. And I'm very afraid for where our society is.
Well, you one time told me, and I've forgotten how many species you thought there were around galaxies and interstellar space, but it was quite a few.
Yes. I think the variety of visitors is another example of the infinity of creation. There are no two exactly alike. And I get to this conclusion because of about 115 cases I've looked in great detail, studied them for years, and only two of those might have been coming from the same place, and that was Reticulum, but they came from different planets than one of the sun systems there, and they were not exactly the same species.
I had a fellow on in Loplin who insists that he's been able to witness with special night vision goggles Star Wars-type activity going on. Have you run across, is there any battles going on out of there, or are they all enlightened at this point?
You know, I don't know of any battles that are going on out there, but I am convinced in my own mind that we have scores of Earth-made flying discs made in the United States that can take off from their underground bases, go into orbit, and stay as long as their food supplies last, and come back under their own power and land in their underground bases again.
So in other words, you don't find it stretching the imagination at all when we talk about a secret space force going on right now.
No, I think we have squadrons.
You're an old Air Force guy.
How do you keep that quiet? If I went to space and went around to a base on the moon or Mars or someplace, I'd have to tell somebody. I guess that's the reason I'm not doing it.
They tell me that there is a special academy out in the Colorado Springs area that when all of the plebes for the Air Force Academy arrive, they're screened for new plebes that have short family connections. They are either foster children, orphans.
And we talked about that with the Serpo story. These 12 that they chose, or 10 or ever how many there were, that they didn't have families.
Well, that's true. But people that work in the space program, flying discs, are chosen the same way, so they have no tight family connections. And when they accept a commission into that society, they don't change jobs like other officers do. They stay in the same job for the whole career, and when they retire, they just take off their uniform and go back to work in civilian clothes. Can't leave. They can only leave those facilities together or with others, like watching each other. And the perks are such that they're paid so well, and they have the best of all available.
So they have some sort of additional pro-pay bonus system where it's worthwhile.
The best food, the best entertainment, the best everything in their underground facilities. There's nothing better that they can get when they get out of there. They've paid well, and they have nice bank accounts and everything. If they defect, they lose their perks, and they probably are not going to live very long. And so they all know this. They're not going to break the rules.
And we talked in Laughlin, a harrowing story about a couple of people getting knocked off investigating things. So you have no doubt that it's a pretty dangerous job if you go investigate a UFO or start talking about it.
Yes, and I had one of our...
I'm talking about up in New Mexico. Remember that Holloman...
I had a Marine sentry from level 2 of S4 come to me one time. He told me that after his quarterly annual physical examination, they called him in a couple of days later and told him that he was dying of a fatal disease, and they were going to discharge him from the service and send him home so he could straighten out his affairs before he perished. They told him he had less than 2 weeks to live. Well, he knew if he had a disease, he's living internally on level 2 of S4 that's perfectly sanitary, not exposed to anything, that if he has a fatal disease, they have given it to him, his superiors, because he is... was also, all of the sentries there were used as government assassins. They don't call them assassinations, they call them missions. But those special forces troops like that are recruited at a very young age, on 17 or 18, where they're very impressionable. And they go through training exercises that make them weep when the flag goes up and down the flagpole. They're so patriotic. And they're prepared. They told and reminded all along that they're... job, there's an elite force, their job is to take care of the enemies of the American government. So they learn to believe their superiors implicitly. If anybody is characterized as an enemy of the American government and it's their job to take him out, they don't hesitate. Even if it would be their mother or a brother, they wouldn't hesitate. So that's that kind of training they had. Now, they call those operations special operations. They get $5,000 each for one. And they don't consider it murder. I consider an execution like that a murder. And this guy had done 18 of them. And I told him, don't you think you might be getting vulnerable about now? You know too much about everything. You're becoming a liability, not an asset anymore. And he says, yes, I think that's what's happened. He says, I think they have come to that conclusion, too, and they have given me this disease. I said, well, let's go to a doctor and get it checked to see what we can do about it. He says, I don't want to know about it. If I'm going to go, I don't want to be waiting to die. He says, I don't want to know, but I'm going to bring their house of cards down if I can before I go. And he started giving me information on what was happening at level 2 of S4.
And do you know what happened to him? Did he die?
They finally killed him, yes.
Did he die right away? Or?
He didn't die right away. He lived for another month or so before I lost track of him.
And what kind of stuff did he tell you?
Well, he was going to take a shower, and he took the stuff out of his pockets and put it on my coffee table in my living room. Then he went in to take a shower, and I knew he was going to be in there for 5 minutes or more. So he laid his wallet on the table. He'd been giving me a name, that his name was Connor O'Ryan. So I thought, let's look in there and see what his name is. And I looked in his wallet, and his name was not Connor O'Ryan. That was a false name he was using. His real name was Derek Hennessy. And he had it folded in. He told me that he had good business cards, good credit cards, and he had Diners Club, and he had American Express, and all the good cards. And he told me that he had $300,000 in the bank, but he couldn't draw any out after he left. His banks were, his accounts were all frozen, and he feared the worst. So I also found folded up tight in between the cards was a W-4. You know what that is? That's a withholding statement.
Right.
A W-4 from his employer, the Central Intelligence Agency at Langley Field. He had a Central Intelligence number. He had a Central Intelligence code name. He was drawing $72,000 a year from Central Intelligence in addition to his Marine pay. And so I know that we have people like that. And he had just, there was also a copy of his last hit in there, and it was an American Green Beret, Army Green Beret in Budapest, Hungary. He left his level 2 position in S4 out in Nevada there, took an airline down to Los Angeles, all tickets provided by the government, another ticket to take him to Budapest. He was met at Budapest by the American Embassy staff car, picked up at the airport and driven to the American Embassy, where they took his American clothes away and gave him Hungarian clothes, Hungarian shoes, Hungarian pistol with Hungarian bullets in it, a key to an apartment rented in a Hungarian name, and told him that he was being paired with another special force troop to carry out this hit. They had something like 4 days to carry out the hit and leave. And there was also, he was given a picture profiled in side view of the hit, where he lived, the routes he took to and from church, to his grocery store, to his work and back, and where the kids went to school. And together they shot him to death coming out of a grocery store in front of his teenage kids in the car.
And they caught the airplane and went home.
And they just disappeared and just blended with the crowd, walked back to the American Embassy. Why, they took up their pistol and clothes.
You know who this fellow was that they knocked off? I mean, was he an important person?
I don't know. He was an American Senior Master Sergeant Green Beret, Army Green Beret. So he told me that he had carried out a special mission just a few weeks before that, and I said, "Don't you think that's making you vulnerable?" He said, "I think so." He said, "I know that I have eliminated a few others that I had doubts about, but my superiors had the information. They characterized them to me. They know." And so I believe that he would accept whatever his superiors told him as gospel fact. He would carry out the hit with no remorse. He doesn't feel bad about it. He's eliminating an enemy of the American government, which he's trained to do. And they don't call them assassinations at all. I think it's strictly government assassination.
Ask you what I thought about the secret government. That story is even more revealing. They got a lot of people doing a lot of dirty things, huh?
Well, we shouldn't be talking about that on the radio.
Wendell, thanks very much for coming by. Our time's up on this thing. You're going to just keep on going, right?
Maybe not after this.
Well, hey, don't make me lay awake at night. I appreciate the story, though, but maybe there's something about telling things in public. Maybe we'll be okay, both of us.
Well, I don't know.
Have you had any threats recently? I know you have.
No, I used to get death threats. I haven't had any recently. Maybe get some now.
Well, okay, you heard it from Wendell Stevens. We'll keep an eye open. We'll be reading the papers.
Yeah.
Good luck, Wendell.
Okay,
thanks very much. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, Jerry.
It's Jerry Pippin. We're broadcasting from the Ozark Conference. I'll be back in a minute. The Elvis Presley Store, a collector's item thought to be extinct until recently. Now, all 13 hours of this famous worldwide radio broadcast series, produced in the 70s by rock and roll legend Ron Jacobs from Watermark Productions and heard around the world and hosted by Wink Martindale, is now available on CD. Hear the complete story, from the cradle to the grave, Elvis Presley. He was truly the king of rock and roll. The Elvis Presley Story is a collector's item with all of the music and the people who made Elvis the king of rock and roll. Order now. Limited time discount price, $39.95 plus $5.95 shipping. Don't miss
The Elvis Presley Store, available to you exclusively through this radio offer. Order now the Elvis Presley Story. Hurry, supply is limited.
It's love,
Jerry Pippin, and of course we're here at the Ozark UFO Conference. 20th anniversary, as a matter of fact, here at the end of the Ozarks. It's a great conference, always is. Adam Johnson, how are you?
Hey, I'm really good. How are you?
Good. So you do a little work with Ted Phillips, huh?
Yeah, we're actually part of the Special Investigations Unit, and we're out of Missouri. And we're investigating various sites throughout Missouri, and one in particular known as the Marley Woods.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about that. I like the name.
Yeah. Well, the Marley Woods has been active for over 40 years, and...
Wait, first of all, where is the Marley Woods?
Well, it's in...
Where are they?
Yeah. Well, the Marley Woods is in the central United States, and the property owners
Is it close to Fort Leonard Wood or Jefferson City, or what part of Missouri?
Well, that's the thing. The property owners are kind of...
You don't want to tell me.
Yeah.
Okay, I got you. I'm a little slow. But it's in the central part of the state, probably.
Yeah. And... Well, basically, for over 40 years, there's been, you know, sightings of these light balls that have been, just actively inserting themselves into this area. And what we've done is...
Are we talking about balls of light like the traditional orbs we hear about? Or
no. See, that's the thing is... You usually hear about orbs, but
yeah. What
we like to consider orbs that most people think of is the kinds that you get on, you know, digital camera,
sure,
which is kind of like dust or some sort of particles. But the ones that we are seeing are typically between the size of a baseball and a beach ball size. So, and they're all white. And on in other instances,
are they bright? Or
yeah, they're definitely bright, but not so bright to where they're gonna, you know, make you squint or anything. They're like self-illuminated, and it's very weird when you see one of these.
Now, there's more than one of these here in the Marley Woods?
Oh, yeah. In one instance, there's a case that Ted's talked about numerous times where he's actually been out there and seen something where they've been out there and, you know, they see one of these little white balls come on, and within minutes, you know, they start seeing 20. And even in one instance, I guess they've had up even close to 100 at one time.
Or do they fly in clusters, or they just hang around, or what? How do they behave?
Yeah, I think clusters. That's a good way of kind of putting it. And but they do, you know, they part away from the cluster at times. And there's another instance where there were a couple attorneys actually out of the site, and. They were viewing a cluster in the distance, and out of this cluster came two of these balls of light. And as these balls of light approached, one of them made a right-angle turn and went into the forest, but the other continued and actually went between the two lawyers. And that's just, you know, that shows intelligence. You know, there's, you know, earth lights or whatever you want to call them. You know, something's not going to do that just, you know, out of random seed, you know.
There's reports of, you know, throughout Arkansas and Oklahoma and Missouri, like the lights up by in Oklahoma, past Miami, Oklahoma, toward Neosho, Missouri.
Yeah, is it the Joplin spook
lights? Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So it seems to be rather common to this area.
Yeah.
Ted travels all over the world. What's he think?
Yeah, he thinks, you know, there's definitely some hot spots, it seems like. Throughout the state, but not only the state, throughout the entire country, and even throughout the world. And like he says, you know, it seems like the common denominator nowadays is that UFOs are no longer, or I should say flying saucers are no longer flying saucers. You know, they've either upgraded or downsized or something, and so the technology's changed, and it's starting to be more of a light phenomenon, kind of like, you know, just light balls instead of actual.
Do these things make noise?
No, completely silent.
Do they ever touch anybody?
Well, in one case, now this is a case where we didn't actually, I guess property owners did not have, they didn't see any lights per se, but they felt an effect of some sort of unseen force that pushed them down to the ground.
Have you been out there to the Marley Woods?
Oh, yeah, I've been out there seven or eight times. Yeah, we were out there actually November of last year, and that was the time that we, as an entire group, all of us were able to experience this, and that was November 16th.
So it's not an individual hallucination?
No way. I mean, we have 194 witnesses total of this area, so, yeah, it's either a mass hallucination, which isn't occurring, because, I mean, we have this on, you know, camera, so.
So what do you make of it yourself personally?
Well, it's really hard to say, you know, where it's from or why they're here, but or what it is in the first place. But it's definitely something that needs to be investigated.
Well,
further.
You alluded that it showed some intelligence.
Yeah.
So do you think they're living things, or are they remote controlled robotic things, or what?
Yeah, I would say that from hearing all the other cases and stuff, I would say it's some sort of maybe a probe, you know, something that's, in my opinion, possibly, you know, just seeking out the area and just maybe gathering data and just basically research, you know. So I think it's just, possibly a remote-controlled craft.
I wonder why they are concentrating. You mentioned this Marley Woods. It got its name. It must be a wooded area with hills. And
yeah, definitely.
I mean, what are they looking for there?
Yeah, exactly. And at times, these things, you know, it seems like they just wink in and wink out. But we've actually had video footage, and it's on our new DVD, SIU Files Into the Marley Woods. And you can see mystery light.
On that link, on that website, right?
Yeah, well, on the website, UFOphysical.com, mm-hmm. You can purchase that DVD. But in the DVD itself, the mystery light, which we saw back in November, it doesn't just blink out. We thought it blinked out, but it actually dives down at least 100 feet within the third of a frame. So, I mean, these things are moving so fast.
Quick.
I mean, yeah, they're moving fast.
Kind of like the Roswell rod or whatever that moves around and nobody saw it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so, yeah, they're very elusive, and we're just trying to
pinpoint.
They're
always circular?
At times they're oblong and... But yeah, normally they tend to be circular.
And no noise.
No noise at all.
And no one's been injured by them.
Well, that's the thing is that the couple that I mentioned was pushed down, and actually one of the guys injured his leg very badly and was in the hospital for nearly 6 weeks and almost lost his wife.
Was it from a hiding from this thing, or did they think the thing did it?
Yeah, well, they think something possibly of that nature may have done this.
Was it what sort of injury?
Well, it was a leg injury, and I believe his leg...
Is there any evidence of radiation, or do you know?
No evidence of radiation at all. But his leg, I believe, struck a tree stump, and that badly injured his leg, caused a blood clot, and, like I said, in the hospital for several weeks.
Well, was he trying to get away from it, or did he pick it up and push him toward the tree stump?
No, he was actually just standing there. And, you know, just out of nowhere, this something he felt pressure on the back of both of his shoulders, and he was struck down to the ground by some unseen force. And it happened the same way to his wife.
How did they describe it? As like a force like a punch? Or?
Yeah, basically just like a punch on one side of the shoulder and then right onto the other side of the shoulder.
So and there may be some evidence that... if you're too inquisitive or you're where they are, they may not like it.
Yeah, who knows? I mean, it's not, you know,
I
that's...
I mean, have you felt any fear out there in the woods investigating?
Well, with the fact that they actually have a mountain lion out there.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there's actually a mountain lion out in this area, and so that's a little, I guess, alarming going out there with unarmed, you know, so... I would say that's probably the only fear I've had of anything is...
Have you ever had a traditional UFO sighting?
No, I would say this is basically the only thing I've had. My father back in the mid-70s, he's always told our family about a traditional saucer sighting that he had close up, close range, I'd say a few hundred feet actually above his car in, you know, the middle of the night. And that's pretty typical over the years. So,
how did you meet Ted Phillips?
Well, being involved with MUFON, I actually met Ted at the International MUFON Symposium back in, I believe, 2006.
You're talking about the Missouri MUFON?
Yeah. Well, actually, the Mutual UFO Network, just their international symposium.
Okay.
And
in Denver at that time.
Yeah. And through Missouri MUFON, Bruce Whiteman, he introduced us. And, yeah, me and Ted, we've hit it off. And, yeah, we've become great friends. And we couldn't be happier with the team we have.
Yeah. Ted's had some interesting adventures for sure.
Oh, yeah, no doubt about it. I mean, we just got back from Aztec, New Mexico. And there we revisited the Socorro UFO landing site, and we also visited the alleged Aztec crash site. So,
tell me a little bit about what you saw out there. I mean, it's pretty much out in the middle of nowhere.
Where?
In near Aztec.
Okay. Yeah.
At the crash site.
Well, we didn't have any direct sightings or anything, but getting out there, actually, you know, people like to talk about, you know, this happened, that happened, but they've actually never been anywhere. You know, if they're talking about something, they just kind of armchair research.
Mm-hmm.
And just being out there.
Well, that's the reason I was asking you about.
Yeah, exactly.
Describing the scene.
Yeah, being out there and actually being in the same location where Lonnie Zamora saw the this craft land, you know, you can see that, you know, the view he had, he you could tell that, you know, there's no way this thing was a hot air balloon or some sort of, you know, just technology that is conventional.
It sounds like you've been interested in UFOs all your life.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no question about that. Ever since just, you know, being a youngster, I've always believed there's life elsewhere. And just, you know, learning about the phenomenon, you know, watching television, reading magazines and books, just, you know, getting...
What other projects are you guys working on?
Well, one of the main projects that I guess we're collectively working on and always trying to get done is the Project Moonshaft. And
tell me a little bit about that.
Well, Ted could give you a lot more detail into that, but basically the Moonshaft project is about this subterranean artifact, which was found by...
Is this the one that makes the vibration or the tone or the?
Well, actually, yeah. This thing did. It was heard making vibrations underneath the limestone in this cave that was found, and it was a black gigantic
monolith type thing.
Yeah, exactly. Just a gigantic artifact of unknown origin, and so we're trying to get back out there. We just need some funding. And, of course, that's, you know, always difficult to come across, but we really think we have the location where we're, you know, 85% sure.
Eastern Europe or someplace?
Yeah, that's in Slovakia.
Uh-huh.
And Ted's been out there twice, and doing it, you know, as a one-man crew, as he's done those past two times, you know, it's much harder. But now as we have the SIU team, Special Investigations Unit, we really feel, you know, with our collective minds and talents that we can really get in there.
How many people in your team?
Five. It's me, Adam Johnson, Ted Phillips, Tom Ferrario, Debbie Ziegelmeyer, and Chuck Sukowski.
All of you Missouri guys?
Well, actually, four of us are Missouri, and one of us is in Colorado Springs, to be exact.
Our time is almost up here. But I thought it'd be interesting for our listeners to meet some of the people behind the scenes. We hear about Ted and we hear about other things, but this unit is actually fairly new, right?
Yeah, they actually we got this started January of 07, so we've been over a little bit of a year now, and we got our website, as I said before, www.ufophysical.com, and we update that very frequently, and we actually keep our cases current. And our main goal is to insert ourselves into an active UFO site. So
Well, it sounds like you're well on the road to doing that.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you think we'll ever find out the real story behind UFOs?
Well,
I know you're doing your part to try to reveal
it. Yeah, I sure hope so. Otherwise, I wouldn't be doing this. I think in time, no doubt about it.
Yeah, you mentioned these lights or spheres or whatever we're going to call them is maybe a new technology.
Yeah.
In other words, the ETs are using robotics as well.
Well, possibly. And, you know, I don't want to pigeonhole it and leave it at ETs, but anything.
It's a supernatural.
Dimensional,
thing.
Whatever. Yeah, exactly. And even parallel universe, you know, it's just whatever this thing is, you know, whatever they've been, whatever they may be now. Yeah, it seems like it's definitely the phenomenon is changing, that's for sure.
Appreciate you stopping by.
Oh, sure. Anytime.
And it's been fun and very interesting. And I have a hunch this special investigation unit's going to do some good.
Oh, well, we definitely hope so. Thank you.
Okay, we talked about Ted Phillips. Let's do that interview we did with Ted that year, 2008, in Eureka Springs.
Jerry Pippin, and we are here in Eureka Springs, Arkansas, at the Ozark UFO Conference. And this is the 20th year, Ted Phillips.
Yes.
I met you here several years ago for the first time.
Indeed, yes.
And we had a great show.
Mm-hmm.
And you talked about this thing you found in a cave over where, in Yugoslavia or someplace?
Slovakia.
Okay, that was close.
Yeah. in the neighborhood.
why don't you tell us a little bit about that right off the bat for people who, we do still have that interview available if people would like to find it. We had your picture there on a gallery of guest, and click on Ted Phillips' picture and you can hear it, but give us a recap here of what's happening.
Yeah, what we're calling it currently is Project Moonshaft, and
why did you guys name it that?
Well, the gentleman that found it, a Czech engineer, Antonin Hurok, was hidden in the cave from the Germans in October of 1944. During the war, and when he finally reached this thing a couple of miles deep in the cavern, it was a sort of vertical shaft, and the overall shape of this structure is sort of a fat crescent moon, and so he named it the Moon Shaft, and so we've kind of carried that along, and
now, have we figured out what that stuff's made of?
No, we don't know. I've been to Slovakia on two occasions.
Yeah.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
And each time by myself, and it's you can't get quite enough done under those circumstances. But I did find what I believe is the cave. And there are a lot of indicators in the first couple of thousand feet of the cave. And I have the original 1944 sketch of the cavern in great detail from Hurok. And at least the first 2,000 feet, it matches the sketch. And unfortunately, in the early 1945, the Russians did a lot of aerial bombing in that area, and craters are still visible, and it has shaken the cave a couple of thousand feet in, and it was pretty risky for a single individual to try to get through the area. It's possible. I mean, I could have done it, but not very wise.
Now, when... we talk about this this object. Does it put off some sort of vibration or tone or something?
Well, I could detect from the surface with a electromagnetic field meter and also compasses by placing them in this one area. Each time I would pass through it on the surface, batteries on the equipment would start dying off and just were dead. And so the third trip through, I took the EM meter and three compasses, and I placed them on the ground in this area, set up the camcorder on a tripod, backed it out of the area, and zoomed in. And all of these instruments were swinging in two-second sweeps. So what was being picked up was a magnetic emission, and on the tri-field meter, an electromagnetic emission. And the interesting thing was, about a week after I did that, I found the cave entrance, and in exploring the cave, I surveyed it, and it was actually turning back in the direction of this area. And the Russians also have found very old manuscripts where villagers described a large, dark object, a curved object that came out of the sky with a great deal of noise and landed on the ground. And the villagers could see it from miles away. It was that tall, but gradually it was getting shorter. And finally it disappeared over a period of about 4 weeks. And the villagers went into the area, and they found not the object, but a large opening in the ground where evidently this thing had somehow pushed itself deep in underground.
So either it was really heavy or it forced its way down there or something.
Yeah, and it was, you know, it was making ear-splitting sounds, whatever that might indicate. But the really interesting thing is the Russians, this particular Russian scientist I'm in contact with, in going into that area, found an electromagnetic emission pulsing on 2 seconds coming out of this hole. So perhaps there are two.
And you think it's still pulsing?
Yes. Oh, yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And this is one reason you think you found the location of the right cave.
Yes, exactly.
And your last trip, you made it a couple of thousand feet down?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
What are we talking about here? Is it like a spelunker trip through Merrimack Cave or something? or are we talking about a little hole in the ground? Or what are we talking about?
Oh, no. It's quite a large cavern. The entrance is very small and low. But the cavern immediately opens up. And it's a very complex cave system, at least the first 2,000 feet. And
by complex, you mean it has lots of entrances or
lots of side passages, other channels that you could travel.
And this fellow who was hiding from the Nazis.
Yes.
How did you find out about him? Was it a diary or something?
Well, I had a friend in 1970 give me a call, and he said, "I have a neighbor you need to talk to." And he knew of my interest, number one, in caves and also in physical evidence relating to UFOs, and so he briefly went through the story, and in less than 2 weeks I was out there, and my wife and I spent 2 days with Hurok and his wife Anna and at their home, and we viewed the 1944 original diary that he had maintained through the war. And while he was in the cavern and inside the structure, he sketched the object. He measured it very carefully. He was an engineer with 4 degrees in engineering, linguistics, and business management. Very intelligent man. And, of course, when the Nazis invaded Czechoslovakia and Poland, they arrested him, put him in a concentration camp, took everything that he and his wife had. And he escaped in 1941 from the concentration camp into Slovakia and joined the Slavic Underground Army. Mm-hmm. And it was during the a large firefight with the Nazis that he and two of his men were seriously injured and wounded. And they woke up the next morning with Slavik, a Slovakian sheepman, treating their wounds, building a stretcher. And he took them to this cave and hid them in the High Tatra Mountains. It's a pretty remarkable story.
It certainly is. And we talk about that. You're pretty certain that And this was an object that fell from the sky because of the stories you've heard or read.
Since then, yes.
Yeah, I mean, the original thing when you told me about the story several years ago, I was thinking about maybe it's the Ark of the Covenant.
Well, you know, you do start thinking along those terms when you, but the fascinating thing about this artifact structure is that the outer wall, which was, of course, the first thing he saw, 2 miles back in the cave, 2,700 feet below the mountaintop. And the outer wall, the exposed area, was framed with cave formations, flowstone and limestone and stalactites. And they were affixed to the wall, the outside of the wall. Well, one thing we know is how long it takes those types of formations to grow. And we're talking many thousands of years. And there was a crack in this wall. The wall itself, as he went through it, measured 7 feet in thickness. And when he was in the interior of this thing, this moon-shaped structure, it went up to an unknown height. He could see, he could light it about 100 feet above him. And it went on. And below him, the very fascinating thing is there is a incline which he thought was the floor of the inside of this thing. And it was a limestone deposit. And he took his military pickaxe and he chopped through this stuff in one of the horns of the crescent and found that it was 60 inches thick. Well, 60 inches of limestone equals about 6,000 years of deposit inside this thing that has flowstone formations on the outer wall. Beneath the 6,000 years of limestone, he finds the skeleton of a very large animal. And he brought out two of the teeth with him, and after the war, had them identified by one of the leading paleontologists as prehistoric cave bear. So we have underneath 6,000 years of limestone the skeleton of a prehistoric cave bear, which the cave bear was about 20 feet long and they weighed about 2 tons.
You
very large.
You wouldn't want to run
no.
into one.
No, you would not. And but the age of the cave bear would be somewhere beyond 100,000 years. Mm-hmm. So you're beginning to add up the fact that this thing is very, very old. And the cave bear skeleton was lying on what he described as a constructed wavy grill work. And he thought he could feel heat coming up through it from below, put his ear and cheek against the grill and could feel warm air coming up, which is a rarity in deep caverns, and at some great distance below him. And remember, this is a very trained, highly trained engineer used to the underground. He could hear what sounded like a large turbine running. So
I remember when you related that story. Mm-hmm. That's where I got it was making some sort of noise.
Yes, exactly. And so, you know, I have the feeling this is something that should be looked at.
And I understand you're putting another expedition together.
Yes,
maybe.
Right. Yeah, the team, as soon as we get the proper funding to do the
What would an underwriter need to do to get a hold of you? You got a great website now.
Oh, it is. Adam Johnson, our webmaster, has done an incredible job with this. And, just go to ufophysical.com. And click on Project Moonshaft, and you can read the original diary. Sketches from the diary are there, along with a lot of other very current and interesting information. So, yeah, we're very proud of the website. Absolutely.
I don't know. I don't know how one goes about getting funding for these sort of things, but I guess. Maybe somebody listening, you never know, they might be interested.
Exactly. And, of course, we do
have... Do you work with a university or anything like that?
We've not had any real luck.
Yeah.
The problem is, unless you have photographs of such a thing, you know, they're not willing to go out on a limb and invest. But there are private individuals a friend of mine who was the CEO of a very large web company funded the second trip over. And, you know, it would not require a tremendous amount of money. Just all we're looking for is enough to get the job done right.
And they can get in touch with you through that website.
Yes, right.
Mm-hmm. I noticed on that website you have something there called Hard Evidence, the Ted Phillips story. I want to find out about what that's all about when we come back. This is Jerry Pippin. We'll be right back. Tales of High Strangeness. Jerry Pippin's Parazone. Check out our stories of the horrific, the interesting, the spiritual on the paranormal pages of jerrypippin.com. Ted Phillips is our guest, and this is Jerry Pippin, and we're broadcasting from Eureka Springs. And Ted, you've been in a lot of countries in your search for. How would you describe what you're searching for?
Well, primarily, my interest is in UFO research involving the landing of flying saucers. Mm-hmm. And in making contact with the ground, leaving behind or generating physical residue. And in other words, not just another story, but something you can put your hands on. And I started this in 1968 at the request of Dr. J. Allen Hynek. And currently we have 3,389 cases involving UFO landings and physical residue.
That many?
From 92 countries, yes.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. A lot of data, really.
Yeah, that is.
Yes.
And what do you draw from this data?
Well, what I can see, based on the facts as they present themselves, that we're dealing with some sort of constructed devices, machines, by virtue of how they're seen, what they do when they're seen, how they interact with the soil and the immediate surrounding area. One of the great things is that in the cases of the larger objects, they land on either three legs or four. And at the end of those legs, of course, are landing pads of various configurations. And by taking compression tests in those footpad marks.
Can you figure out how heavy it is?
Exactly, yeah. And
how heavy is it?
Well, depending on the type of object, mm-hmm. The range runs from 7 to 12 tons. And so, in other words, all of a sudden we're not talking about a story. We're talking about a physical mass.
Right.
Something, without question, was there. And contrary to popular belief, UFOs are not all lights in the distance in the night sky. In the landing cases, a high percentage of those reports are made by multiple witnesses in daylight within 50 feet of the landed object. And over a period of time long enough to be sure it's not the Goodyear blimp,
sure.
Or a hot air balloon or whatever, mm-hmm. that it is indeed something very strange and out of the ordinary. And during that period of time, they see the object generating the physical evidence. And so this puts it in an entirely different light. I mean, you're dealing with something close for a long duration, good seeing conditions, multiple witnesses. The best cases we have, I think.
And these things are similar worldwide?
Yes, they are. Yeah. The really fascinating thing that I learned over many years, too many years perhaps, of researching
these
things.
You'll never catch me. Go ahead. That's one good thing.
Well, the thing that I began to see was that I could go to a new case and without knowing anything about the landing site, talk to the witnesses, interview the witnesses, and determine the approximate size, configuration, description of the object. And before I even went to the site, I had a really good idea of what I was going to find. They are that repeatable. They're consistent. They're like fingerprints.
What are size of these objects? Are they more or less about the same size? Or?
They're not large. You know, occasionally you hear about the 300-foot-long objects
right.
and so on. The landing devices tend to be in a range of 4 to 8 feet, 8 feet to 12, 12 to 18 feet. And those three particular
models.
Types, yes.
Yeah.
And then there's a smaller model, which is less than 1 meter in diameter. And those kind of reports are very much on the increase since the late 90s, whereas the 18-foot jobs are on the decrease.
So the smaller ones, and we've talked to Adam Johnson about this, on his... What do you call that place up in Missouri?
Marley Woods.
Yeah, Marley Woods.
Yes.
How could I forget
yes.
that?
Yes.
Is that what you're talking about, something that may be robotic or something? We don't know what that is.
Yeah, obviously they have to be remotely controlled, unless you have some really little guys.
Yeah, they're really
really. But because...
Reminds me of that old... Twilight Zone with a...
Yes, yes. Yeah, boy, what classics those things were. But when you have an object that's the size of a baseball or a softball, and they are moving around on their own without wings or engines or sound, and yet they also emit an electromagnetic field that will interfere with things in the immediate area. And they'll be seen, for example, a very good example from Marley Woods. One evening, two attorneys, a man and his wife, who were total skeptics, and they'd heard about some lights being seen, so they thought, well, it'd be fun. And they're standing outside their car 10 feet apart, and in the distance, about 1,000 feet, in a tree line, they suddenly see clusters of these small white lights moving around. And they're going from the ground to the tops of trees and in between. And suddenly, two of the objects emerge from the cluster, and they're headed directly toward the two people. And at a distance of about 150 feet, one of the objects makes a right-angle turn, flies across the field, disappears in some dense woods. The second object continues straight at these two and passes by at shoulder height between two people 10 feet apart. That's close. That's very close.
Yeah, and I think Adam told me it didn't make any noise or anything.
No noise, no air disturbance, no sensation of heating or cooling, no electrical shock. They turn, they see it fly out across the gravel road over a field, makes a right angle turn into dense woods, and it's
gone. Some sort of surveillance, maybe.
That seems to be the logical assumption. It really does, yes. But we're having a lot of cases like that. I mean, incredibly close. So our goal is to insert the team into the middle of this sort of stuff while it's going on and get imaging from several units, and also gather instrument data on this stuff so we can begin to understand what's going on.
So in other words, this investigative unit that you're talking about that you put together, what is it, five at this point?
Five, yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You use some high-tech examining stuff, taking measurements, things like that.
Yes.
And, it's kind of like a Ghostbusters, only it's a little...
It's a UFO buster.
Yeah, right, yeah. Right, right.
Yeah. Actually, yes, that's exactly right. And, you know, for 40 years, I would find myself going in behind an event, and you're kind of picking up breadcrumbs. And I always consider the physical traces generated by these objects as fingerprints. And they are similar with similar objects. And so what we're trying to do instead of going in behind is to be there when it happens. And we have three sites now that are tremendously active. And the owners of these areas
are all these
call
in Missouri?
Us, yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And they call us even while they're observing something. And what the pattern indicates over the past 10 years is that when activity begins, you'll have anywhere from 5 to 7 nights of this activity. So we have plenty of time to get there, be there, and observe it.
Now when we talk about that and these three sites, what do you think is so interesting that something would be there?
You know,
the same places over and over.
Yeah, I have looked at everything I can think of, and there's nothing remarkable or unique about these areas. And yet, what makes them tremendously unique is I could stand in my backyard for the next 100 years and not see any of this.
True.
And yet, in these specific areas, you can. Now, why? I don't know. But that's what we're trying to find out. That's one of the legs we're trying to get down. So,
you talked about footprints and fingerprints earlier. Any evidence of real ET prints on any of these landings?
Yeah. Now, I would immediately point out that these
What size shoe.
Yes. these active sites that I just talked about, they have had just about every kind of sighting that you could expect, except no humanoids, no little guys, and no abductions. But in the landing cases, 20% of the 3,389 cases involve little guys.
Really?
Yes. Yeah, which seems to be a pretty high number. And
yeah, it was 700.
Yes. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and from many of the 92 countries. And yet they're described consistently as 3.5 feet tall, thin, spindly bodies, large heads. And by people in countries where they don't read the National Enquirer. So they're not getting the ideas
right.
from somewhere else. And I have been fortunate enough to see a number of the footprints from supposedly these little guys.
Do they have shoes?
Sort of.
Okay.
Yeah, they're not, well, they're not barefoot unless they have really odd feet.
Uh-huh.
And but the really interesting thing is I've been able to run compression tests on the footprints, indicating that whoever left them weighed about 60 pounds, which would be consistent with a 3-foot individual, if I could call them an individual.
Sure.
But anyway.
Well, I call them people. They're an entity of some sort.
Yes, they are. Yes, they
and they're intelligent enough to get in this machine and get here.
Exactly. Yeah, and one would suspect to build that machine.
You've been doing this a long time, though.
Yes, I started actually investigating on my own in 1964 with the Socorro, New Mexico landing, which was a conversion for me, and beginning of the conversion for Dr. J. Allen Hynek.
Now, so you went out there, and you just went back.
Oh, yes, yeah, yeah.
And you've been there probably in between.
Yes, I have, yes.
So what do you make of all that?
Well, the Socorro, New Mexico case is in the top 10 of all these landing cases. And as a matter of fact, in the top 5, it is a tremendous example of a high-quality, high-strangeness UFO landing. And Lonnie Zamora, I don't know where you would find a better witness than this man.
If I remember correctly, he was a policeman?
Yes.
Right.
Yes, yeah. And he was a little short on information because he told it exactly as it was. And no embellishment, no generating a big, wild story. And I know Allen Hynek was tremendously impressed with him. And I have several, in the Socorro files, several little personal notes handwritten by Allen, a lot of them regarding the Air Force investigation.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And we're going to put all that on the website. I'm going to put the entire Socorro file on there. It may take me the rest of my life to get it formatted and on because it's thick. And all the photos, sketches, documents, and so on. So.
What did Hynek really think of the Air Force investigation?
Well, not much.
Okay.
Not much. It was poorly done. It was poorly funded, poorly staffed, and the good stuff was going somewhere other than Project Blue Book.
So Project Blue Book, much like many of the military projects they do, they, I guess redirection would be the best description.
Yeah, it's a very good description, yes. Redirection, yes.
Involved with conspiracy shows for 40 years, and that's basically, that's the standard operating procedure.
Yes, it is.
Give you just a little material there to get you over there on the other. I think a lot of redirection might even happen down in Roswell itself.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, I think you find it in just about any of the events where the military is involved.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting is that through the years I found that military folks, knowing that Alan Hynek was the chief scientific advisor to the Air Force projects, knew everything. And since he and I worked so closely together, they assumed I also knew everything. And I had several lectures at a Strategic Air Command base where there were 150 Minuteman missiles ringing it. And at one of the lectures, I'm sitting at the head table with the base commander and his wife, and she leans over and she says, "Tell Ted about the case when you were flying a B-52 and you saw and photographed a UFO." And he leans over and he tells me the story, you know. And two of the crewmen had cameras, and they shot every frame that they had available of this thing, which was a metallic-appearing disc off the wingtip of the B-52. And they could see structural detail.
Mm-hmm.
And go to the Blue Book files and find that report.
You can't.
Ain't there.
and I
managed to get a number of cases that way.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the military, there's no question, somewhere they have a lot of good information.
Tell us a little bit about the Socorro thing.
Well, the Socorro case involved, as I said, Lonnie Zamora, policeman, tremendously credible guy, and he's in daylight pursuing a speeding car, and out of the corner of his eye, he sees out the left side window a bright silvery object with a throw of bluish flame descending toward the ground. And so he breaks off the chase and turns on a very small, very rough road, dirt road, that runs out into the desert. And this thing is coming down in front of him, and he can begin to see an object. And the blue flame is underneath it. And just before he turns on this road, there is a tourist family of five driving a Cadillac, and they see an object approaching from the west side, and it passes so low over the automobile it almost hits the antenna on top and flies on out, and they see the police officer coming, and they watch he and the object both heading in that direction. And so the thing lands out in the desert. He finally gets a patrol car up on top of this ridge and stops, gets out of the car, and the object is sitting down below him at a distance of about 165 feet. And since we were just there, we could get a very good impression of how much detail you could see from mm-hmm. that distance, mm-hmm. and it's a lot, enough to determine it's not a hot air balloon or a lunar limb.
Right.
And he can see two small guys in what look like white coveralls doing something to the underneath of the object, which is shaped like a large, let's say, propane tank. And it's sitting on four legs, structured legs. And the bushes underneath it are still smoking from evidently some sort of heating. And as he's standing by the car, the two little guys disappear around back of this thing, and there's this tremendous roar, throw of flame, and it leaps about 30 feet into the ground, or into the air, vertically, and becomes stationary, and the roar and the flames stop.
So they jump-started it.
Yes, they did. And I mean big time they jump-started
right.
this thing. 0 to 60 in like that fast.
Yeah, right.
But it maintains that hovering position just very briefly, and then silently it starts flying away. and gaining a little altitude and disappears into the distance. And he had radioed the dispatch for help, and he thought at first it was an overturned automobile when he pulled up on this ridge. And then as he got out and got a better look, he realized what it was. And so a New Mexico Highway Patrolman arrived very shortly on the scene. He and Zamora went down to the site. The bushes are smoking. They've been exposed to several thousand degrees of heating. And they found the four landing pad imprints.
Mm-hmm.
And these imprints, another thing that leads to the idea that this was a constructed, technically good vehicle, Bill Powers at Northwestern University did a very intensive study of the distribution and angles of the imprint positions. And what he determined from this study was that this thing, the landing gear was such that when it touched down, based on the terrain it was landing on, it kept the object perfectly level. So this indicates a little bit of engineering.
Yes.
And so, again, we're away from ghosts and goblins and maybes and maybe nots.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about Aztec? What do you think happened there?
Well, you know, I went on the Internet, and quite frankly, the information I could see on the Internet before going down there, it wasn't too interesting and not very impressive. But when we got down there, and Scott Ramsey, who has done a tremendous amount of research.
Yeah, and his wife.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
He took us out. Stan Friedman and Timothy Good went out, and we had a great time hobbling around the desert. And after hearing the story, seeing the site, and learning new things, it's kind of interesting. It's kind of impressive. And I think a good probability that something, in fact, did happen.
Well, yeah, and the thing about that story that always fascinated me was the Farmington newspaper about the flyover later. They, they had the big story about it.
Mm-hmm.
Back there in the 50s, I'm old enough to remember some of those headlines. You know, not of that particular one, but the Washington, D.C.
flyover. Yeah.
It's on the local paper in my hometown of Muskogee, Oklahoma. I remember seeing
August
the picture of the Capitol and the
August
lights.
Of 52,
I think so.
And, well, I was
July 1, August, I think you're probably right.
I was a very tiny little guy.
Well,
then,
of course, but, you'll never catch me, but as I said earlier.
I didn't read that headline, but I saw it later. But anyway, it is very interesting. And what I found interesting was that the object at the Aztec site presumably didn't actually crash.
Really?
But it was my understanding that the thing actually had landed there and suffered very little, if any, damage.
What about the story about all the 10 little bodies, or 11, or whatever there were?
16,
right,
I think.
Okay.
Yeah. They were all found supposedly inside the object. And there was some theory about some overheating, a flash fire inside the object. And so they were killed by suffocation or fire.
Mm-hmm.
And but it's a case that that we're kind of probing around with, and it's very interesting.
You know, you have a big background of investigating all these things. A lot of things happened in New Mexico.
Yes. Yeah.
You think that was because of our military involvement there, and people were investigating, or?
Well, you would think with
originally,
white sands.
Yeah, originally I thought that, you know, all these things, when I first started doing UFO shows, and then I moved to Las Vegas and did them even more often, I thought, well, it's in the desert. It's one of these things that they like the desert. But but since then we do sighting shows, and they see them in Manhattan all the time, in Chicago, and you name it.
Yeah, hog farms.
Yeah,
Doesn't seem to matter. Well, I do think with something like White Sands, and, of course, where were they launching, testing the German V-2s? And so these were really the first rockets. And there were many sightings over Germany when they were launching V-2s. If you were interested in the advancement, we'll say, of mankind, I think you'd be kind of interested in some of that stuff.
Ted, we're talking about the New Mexico desert. During that time of all these things happening with UFOs, there were a lot of nuclear activity going on as well, tests and things like that out that in the desert.
Exactly.
In Nevada, too. But New Mexico had its share of stuff going on.
Yes, it did.
Any evidence with your experience in the Air Force and SAC and all of that, of any of these stories of disarming nuclear ICBMs? Is that, you know, of any of that a fact, or is that just things we hear?
No, it is. It is fact. I've seen documents obtained through the Freedom of Information Act, primarily by a good friend, Peter Gersten, and there were several instances where the missile sites were incapacitated, and during the overflight of objects. And I was told at another SAC base by the base commander himself of an event in which the alarm went off at one of the missile silos, and he sent out two strike teams armed, and there sitting 80 feet from the missile silo was a landed object. And so the strike team leader called. And at this, by this point, the base commander, it was significant enough, he was in charge of the operation. And the strike team commander asked him, what do you want us to do? And the base commander, it was really funny because, the way he said it to me, and he said, my exact words were, if anything gets out, kill it. And if nothing gets out, leave it alone. And so they sat there for about 20 minutes, and the thing finally takes off, and away it goes. And that was the end of it. And some of those events, evidently, they didn't forward any reports up the chain of command, primarily because they didn't want to be beat to death by people coming down and asking all kinds of questions.
Yeah, that is one of the unintended consequences, I imagine, of investigations, period, especially in the military.
Mm-hmm.
There's probably a lot more of that goes on than we believe.
Oh, yes.
About, oh, don't fill that thing out.
Yes.
They'll be down here tomorrow and we'll never get anything.
Exactly.
Done.
Exactly right. And
I mean, so this human element has
been
part of the problem, mm-hmm. I think, along with a lot of other things.
Exactly right. And what are you going to get out of passing it along? No one's seriously going to look at it.
You don't get promoted that way.
And, no, you definitely don't get promoted that way. And you just get into a lot of problems, time-consuming activities.
Yeah, I've noticed a lot of pilots, when they get together, all of a sudden they start sharing these stories, and
mm-hmm.
there's a lot of things going on.
Yes.
But
you
get them by themselves, so they don't think much about it. Yeah. You know, they don't want to mention it.
Well, and we found in the scientific community, you know, publicly, we have no interest in that stuff, it's bunk. And yet, you talk to some of these same scientists privately, and they'll pump you to death for information, and they are seriously interested.
Oh, I've found that out. We do other kind of shows besides UFO conspiracy shows and things like that, and you run across scientists that you meet on other assignments, and off the air they ask you about UFOs, what you really think. And
mm-hmm. Of course.
It's kind of an interesting subject for everybody.
Yes, it is.
It's the reason we do these shows.
Of course, of course. Yeah, there is a tremendous amount of interest. And the thing that that kind of excites me is wherever you travel on the planet, the one term that everyone in every country understands is UFO.
Well, you got a point there.
And believe me, you will always get new reports.
You know, since we've been on the Internet, and it's been some time now, 99, and the technology's progressed all this time, our audiences, about 35% of our audiences, especially for UFO and paranormal shows, are from around the world.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's an amazing interest everywhere.
It is. It absolutely is. You know, it amazes me when you can travel to, let's say a country like Slovakia, and you're in a very isolated area where communications are minimal, and my Slovakian family, my friends over there, introduced me to a high school director, and one of his teachers, and through their translation, they start to tell me about a daylight sighting of an object that lands on four legs. Two little guys get out, fool around underneath the object for a while, climb back in, take off, and guess what? They left traces on the ground. And it's exactly what you would get in Missouri, in New Mexico, Alaska, you name it, South America. And yet you're getting this in the middle of nowhere where these people couldn't have even read reports like that. And I think it's fascinating. Brazil is another area I hope to be able to get into. And I'm especially interested in the levitation cases. Bob Pratt did a lot of great investigation.
Yes, he did, the late Bob Pratt.
Yes, yes. And he, fortunately, before he passed away, he sent me copies of all of his levitation cases. And, again, these are cases that repeat themselves night after night. The individual, the mother, the daughters, and the dog go out in the evening.
And
they
one
see
of
the
them
little light.
All of them are lifted
all
up.
Of them are lifted up,
okay.
Including the dog. And, you know, if you get one of those, you can say, well, this is goofy stuff. But when you get it over and over and over from different tiny little villages where they don't even communicate between villages, and they're describing the same things, there's something there.
And there always has been a fascination with me about Brazil. There seems to be a lot of things going on.
Yes. Always. Always.
I don't really know how to explain it. The Amazon's one of the few places I've heard where UFOs actually attacking natives. Have you run across other cases where UFOs have done that?
Actually, not outside of South America and probably not outside of Brazil.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a fact.
So I don't know what to make of it.
No.
Trying to put together a reality show here. It would be a good way to underwrite this thing to get Ted back over to Slovakia. What do you think of that for an idea?
I think it's great.
We can take a couple of cameramen and...
Sure.
So, you know, somebody, some television producer out there needs to go to their respective network and get a little funding for Ted here. He's open for it.
Absolutely. We'll take it any way we can get it, yeah. Yeah, I think it is a vastly important project, and Dr. Hynek signed on to it in 1970, and if he liked it that well, that's good enough for me.
How'd you meet him?
I had been investigating cases just privately for 4 years, and in 1968 I ran across a case in which three guys in daylight saw and photographed an object 300 feet away as it was taking off from the ground. And one of these witnesses who took the picture is now in a very high position in government. And they had...
Now that piques my interest.
Well, that could be bad news. Even, but anyway, he... No, this is a great guy. But
right, I didn't want to get into that.
But,
I'm glad you said it, but I agree.
But The thing that really grabbed me was that here you had multiple witnesses, daylight, a good, clear photograph of the object, and $600 worth of damage to their campsite, tents, aluminum cots melted, and so on. And I thought, well, I don't want to just investigate this and throw it in the file cabinet. I'm going to just take a shot. And I called Northwestern University and asked to speak to Dr. Hynek. Lo and behold, he comes on the phone, and I described the case to him, and he said, what are you going to be doing next week? And I said, I guess whatever you want me to do. And he said, I'll be down. And he said, arrange a meeting with the witnesses, which we did, and he took the negatives back to Northwestern. They analyzed them, and I had turned over the cases I had investigated in the previous 4 years to him. And he read those. He called me and he said, why don't you and Ginger come up for a visit? So I went up and I spent 2 days up there with him. And he invited me to join the Invisible College. And how could you turn that down, working with people like Hynek and Powers and Valet and Saunders and, you know. So that's actually
how
it was.
Started,
yeah. And we became tremendously close friends. We investigate a lot of cases together, a lot of sites, and we shared lectures. And one night I had to even give his lecture at a planetarium because he was almost dead with a cold. And so it was great. It was great. He was a wonderful friend. Alan Hynek best said it. He said, it's an itch that ought to be scratched. And I sincerely believe that.
And that's a good way to lead the show. Thank you. Thank you very much. I've always enjoyed seeing you here. And end around, Ted Phillips. The Ozark UFO Conference is one of the better ones. I would suggest if you're in that area, plan on going. It's in April. Check it out on their website and check us out on our website, jerrypippin.com. Thank you for listening, everyone. Until next time, cheers.